Osiris.
I mean, I was jovial because I was saying to myself, you know, look at these great, like, civil rights leaders that sort of haunt you. You think about them all the time. Because I do think about the history of the South constantly. Because I don't know, I'm from a lot of generations in the South, and there's a lot, you know what I mean? And there's a lot of, like, things in our past.
Hi, this is Maggie Rose. You're listening to Salute the Songbird on Osiris Media. Salute the Songbird is a platform for women in music to share their stories and let their voices be heard. And everyone has a seat at the table.
It's your host, Maggie Rose, and I'm so excited to be coming to you with a brand new episode of Salute the Songbird. It's so good to be back. I've been nice and busy. In fact, I'm coming to you from the back of my tour bus in Springfield, Missouri, where I'm opening up for Marcus King this evening. But let's get to this wonderful episode because I'm interviewing the one and only Amy Ray, who's a groundbreaking artist whose songwriting threads personal storytelling with observation of our collective history. Her 10th solo album is called If It All Goes South, and it's a wonderful representation of her talent and the positivity she imbues, and it allows us a glimpse of the South and all of its beauty and imperfection through her lens. In my conversation with Amy, we talk about the making of the record and the dazzling lineup of guest musicians who appear, a lot of them women, including Brandi Carlile, Allison Russell, and Natalie Hemby, to name a few. You know, Amy is the co-founder of Indigo Girls, of course, so we also talk about the formation of the band, her relationship with Emily Saliers, the other half of Indigo Girls, and their commitment to giving back to their community. Amy tells me about important lessons she's learned from her mentors and how her perspective has shifted as she's gotten older. My conversation with Amy was incredibly inspiring and one that I think you'll find both useful and uplifting. It's so good to be back. Here's my conversation with Amy Ray. How you doing?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Your newest record is so great. I was listening to it because I just wanted to, you know, figure out what's going on with you right now. And
yeah, it's ever changing, as you know.
Yeah.
But isn't that what being a human is?
Yeah.
I mean, your career, you've been never afraid to evolve and change and explore different sides of yourself and also kind of point the mirror at the world around you. And that's no exception with your latest album, If It All Goes South. It is so good and so rich.
Oh, thanks. Jeez, thank you. That's a huge coming from you.
And so timely. I think, you know, I have more questions that I want to get into later in a more specific way. But, you know, I think most people listening are going to know about your career, the fact that you've been one half of the Indigo Girls. This is now your fourth decade of making music and fantastic music at that. But If It All Goes South is your 10th studio release. You did it all to tape, which is very nerdy and cool of you. And it sounds so warm and awesome. And I kind of want to know what went into that. But what allows you to kind of separate what you do with Emily in the Indigo Girls and what you want to keep for your own solo projects? Because there is a pretty stark delineation, I think, between the two different efforts.
Yeah, I mean, when I started doing solo stuff, it was like 2001, and I had an indie label called Damon Records, and I had been putting out other people's music. We had put out about 60 records, And most of them were veering towards punk or, you know, we did a couple hip hop records and jazz, but like punk rock side of things. So a lot of those folks I collaborated with. So the earlier stuff was pretty easy because it was like, you know, more punk rock. And then I went into making more like country records. And I think it's just like who the collaborators are tends to influence. Like when I'm writing, I can kind of hear, like my band right now, my country band, I've been with them for about 9 years. So I can hear them, you know, in my head.
Yeah.
When I'm writing. And before it was just like I wanted to write stuff that was more singular in its focus, I think. And sometimes Emily and I would talk about like new songs and she wouldn't feel as, I don't know, down with some of the stuff I was writing that was more like strident, I guess, and more about gender and being queer and sort of gender politics and stuff. I mean, she's down with it now, of course. I think it was just the time period. She was like, I don't know if I can relate to that or whatever. And we're always really open with each other. And so it kind of made me start thinking about solo projects at the time. Cause I was like, well, maybe I just need like an outlet for this stuff. Cause it was definitely like me struggling with my own internal sort of journey in all that, you know, when I met some of the younger kind of punk musicians that were more in the world of gender dysphoria and queer politics and stuff. It was very different from my kind of feminism and sort of what would be like lesbian politics, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a different force. And also I just really wanted to get back to like being in a van and fix my own amp and, you know,
yeah.
driving around, you know, just the process is, I love the process of like touring and having a label and, you know, that side of things is fun to me. I'm kind of a closet manager, I think.
Yeah.
Like I would love to manage people's careers, you know? So, yeah. And so now it's just when I'm writing, I can hear the difference. There are some songs that could go either way, I guess, but, you know, I usually hear my band in my head or I hear Emily, you know, singing or playing guitar.
Yeah.
So it's an inspiration thing, just like a muse.
And I imagine that you being able to have that outlet of your own solo material also allows for such a long, sustainable, collaborative relationship with Emily, because, you know, we have multitudes within us and I think we have to feed the desire to express those things.
Yeah, I definitely. I mean, and Emily's made a great solo record a few years back, which did the same thing for her, I think, you know, because she wanted to do something that was very pop and experimental, and which I love. But I think I don't write as well in that genre, although I want to. But she needed to be set free a little bit. So she did that too. And she wrote a book with her father, who is a theologian. Yeah, we both have like our things. And she tends to co-write like in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And I just never do that. Although I'd like to be good at that. I don't know if that's my wheelhouse, you know, but like she's great at it. So yeah, we each have our little things and it's like a good marriage, you know, you just,
right.
And everything that we do alone, it definitely adds to us as a duo. Cause like we bring in new information or she'll meet musicians that I don't know and kind of bring them into the fold, and we'll have different people open for us that she's co-written with, or she'll turn me on. Like she introduced me to Natalie Hemby, who I ended mm-hmm. up having sing on the record, you know, and I didn't know her before. And years ago, she introduced me to her music and I was like, oh, this person's so cool. So that happens. And then sometimes if there's something I'm doing solo, you know, like a way of recording or like something technical, I'll bring it into the studio with us and be like, you know, I tried this trick. Can we do that? You know, whatever. So it's good. It's just like a good marriage. It's lasted a long time because we're free and try not to get possessive and jealous of each other's, you know, lives and careers and stuff. And we've never, you know, we've been friends since we were 10, but we haven't really ever, we never dated or had anything like that complicate things either, which mm-hmm. I think has probably helped us a lot, you know, to stay together.
Yeah, I think people probably imagine, you know, a successful band like the Indigo Girls having been together for so long that you guys are just constantly together and from what I've heard in, you know, various interviews from you, that's not the case. You have your own families, you live in different cities, you have a different group of friends, and that just makes you cast a wider net for what observations you both can be bringing back to the table when it is time to collaborate and have a collective thought in your music together.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's exactly it. You've got it, you know? I mean, of course you understand because you're out there doing it.
But yeah, you can burn out. And I do think that we prioritize our collaborative relationships because we know how important they are and how fleeting that kind of chemistry can be. But in order to be able to do this as long as you've been doing it and want to continue doing it, I think we have to have boundaries on, you know, how much of our personal lives are being diluted by the effort of our creative lives. And they are very much intertwined, but I think there is a healthy balance that can be achieved. And I'm still working on that myself. And I know a lot of artists out there who just think everything is connected. But I think that just makes for richer art when you are able to be mindful and present in your actual life.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend yesterday who lives in Nashville and about like how I would imagine it's harder if you, I mean, I love Nashville, but if you live there, it's like everything feels like it's part of the same tapestry in some way. And I'm like, God, how would you find that space where you just, you go hiking with your kid and you don't think about all this other stuff? You know, it seems like everything overlaps in a beautiful way too.
Yeah.
But like, how would you find that balance? You know, that's, I was thinking a lot about that because I have a lot of friends that live there and I'm impressed, you know, when they can just like, hey, I got to take a break and go home and fix dinner for my kid. And they can compartmentalize and keep a balance, but still be in it, you know, wherever they are, which I've learned from watching, actually.
That is one thing about the culture here that I've learned. I've lived here for 15 years and been able to work in other cities. And we work smarter, not harder, I think. I mean, people do have a home life and get home for dinner, and that is something that I think is still prioritized and made time for, but it's eroding a little bit. That environment is starting to slip away a little bit here just because it's becoming a busier town. And I also think just with the demand on artists to be performative and always visible is making for a little bit of a dilution of just quality time with ourselves and our thoughts. And we have to be wholehearted people to make wholehearted music. So kudos to you for creating that for your family. Being a mother in this industry as you are, I know it's something that you've always wanted to do, but how has that influenced your perspective in your writing, especially with this recent album? Because I feel like you really are taking a look at this ever-evolving world around us and calling it out for all of its flaws, yet you have joy in this music. It's a very complicated relationship with the South and with the current events of what's going on in the world. How does your perspective as a mother factor into your hopelessness or hope-filled idea of it all?
Well, you know, you relive it, like you relive a lot of things with your kid because they're asking you questions all the time, you know? So you're relitigating and rekindling sort of curiosity about why things are, and because you have to answer these questions in some way, you know, and sometimes they're really deep. Like, you know, when I look at the stars, my stomach feels weird. You know, why is that?
Oh my gosh. That just gave me goosebumps.
I'm like, it's infinity, actually. Makes you feel funny, you know? And also just like thinking about, she's, you know, a 9-year-old girl and I want her to be able to be whatever she wants to be. So you think, I mean, you just think about that, you know, and she's just confronting, you know, what is racism? What, you know, she hears all these things. Why do people get killed at school? You know, just really big things. And so I think for me, it just gets into your head and you, it comes out in your writing in some way. You know, maybe it's just images or maybe it's one line in a song, or maybe like she's the reason I start the song, or I'm, you know, I see her as a metaphor for something. So it's just there. It's just part of your life so much that it's just in it, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time, like, I'm not one of those people that wants to write a lot of songs specifically about her or for her, but things happen. I just let things happen. And so, like, when I started this song called From This Room on If It All Goes South.
Such a good song.
It was kind of like a love song to my friends on the road, you know, and how I knew what they were experiencing, and just a few people I knew that were having trouble, right? Mm-hmm. And I didn't ever finish it. And then I finished it for this record, and it sort of became more of a song towards the end of the song to my kid, you know, for like when she gets older, the things that I would want to say to her, you know, when I'm gone, because I'm an older parent. So mm-hmm. she's going to be, you know, learning a lot of things later, and I won't be around to be, you know, talking to her about it. So I keep like a diary to her, and then sometimes things like I'll be writing a song and something will enter into it. So that happens. And I think like time management changes, obviously. So you end up writing in shorter increments sometimes. Although I have a partner who's Carrie, she's amazing. She's a filmmaker. And so she's pretty busy too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she does a lot of the heavy lifting when I'm on the road. You know what I mean? But I go out for a couple of weeks at a time, and sometimes longer right now because we're making up for all the COVID cancellations. But, you know, she helps a lot. So life just becomes a different way of organizing, you know? And so, like you said, you have to be good at like work smarter and not harder sometimes, like just good with your time.
Anyone can sing this song. It's been written a million times. Where we watch our life unfold and the love comes down the line. I want you to have this life. Hold it up in the darkest night while you are sleeping on that long, long road.
I mean, I think that it's beautiful that you're leaving her songs and an instruction manual or just thoughts. But I think the mothering really began before she ever even arrived. I mean, you've been doing such wonderful work with your activism, with gun control, with Indigenous people, of course, with the LGBTQIA community, and not only just being visible as a member of that community, but also just provoking questions and constant growth and consideration of everyone involved in that community and all the iterations and the constant changing of like these absolute identity terms that we're all trying to stick on different people. It's a lot to navigate, but you do it with a lot of grace, and you were just awarded the Spirit of Americana Award at the last annual Americana Honors and Awards show for your work as a songwriter and an artist, but very much an emphasis on the activism that you and Emily have done. And Brandi Carlile, of all people, presented you with this award. I know what a role you played in her life as well. Was there a like mission statement with you and Emily back in Atlanta when you started this whole thing? Or did it just happen organically? Because it just feels like you're so much on the same page with that work that you've done.
Yeah. I mean, we were in like high school. So, you know, the mission was let's have fun. Yeah. I mean, honestly, you know.
A very evolved high schooler, I have to say.
Yeah. When we first started, it was just having fun, and we already had a sense of community because our parents, although my parents were more conservative than hers, and they were Republican the whole time I was growing up. And then I think they really moved more to the center. And now my mom's kind of on the left. My dad's passed away. But yeah, we thought, and her parents were very community minded. Her dad's a theologian. So we were very like steeped in like, give back to your community, give back to your community. You know, in my life, it was in the form of tithing, you know, like money and time, right? Mm-hmm. And church, you know, 5 days a week and stuff, and youth group and camp, Christian camp, boy. And all that stuff. So, you know, I had a lot, but I took the good things from it, you know, the bad things I'm still wrestling with, but the good things were really good. You know, I had a lot of really good role models, actually, that were just all about like how to give back, you know, so we both had that. And when we were on the scene in Atlanta, just sort of getting started in the bar scene, what we realized, because we saw people, you know, with AIDS and HIV and a lot of homeless people in the areas that we played in, And we just started thinking about, like, you know, what can we do? And it was, so it was more like homeless projects and like Meals on Wheels and very community. And we realized you could get a bunch of musicians together, have a really good time and raise money for causes. And that was like, oh, you know, eureka for us. We were so young.
Yeah.
So it became just part of our thing, you know, like part of what we are going to do is like raise, do these shows where we get friends together and we raise money. And then it's just expanded, you know, into like whatever. But we were doing environmental work and kind of with like Greenpeace and Sierra Club and more kind of straightforward stuff. And those groups, I have to say, have evolved a lot as far as indigenous issues and representation. And they're amazing now. But when we started, a lot of environmental work was very segregated to like white mainstream work or like people in the communities of color, you know, that were not probably noticed as much, that were doing a lot of really hard work. And we had heard Winona LaDuke speak. She's a Native activist. And that's when we kind of steered over into the indigenous environmental work. And it informed everything that we do because of the model of how they do activism. So any, you know, gun safety sort of causes and legislation that we get involved with is always based on like a community-based model, like every town and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. and the queer work is the same. You know, we try to work with small, sort of very community-based groups that are working on things like, you know, racism in the queer communities or homelessness in queer communities, suicide with queer youth, you know, things like that. So trans women being targeted a lot for, you know, abuse and murder. And we just see everything as a community model. So, yeah, I mean, I think it just, we had this mission as part of what we do, but it wasn't like, oh, we've got to carry this burden and be like, you know, fundraisers. It was more like, this is really fun. And it yeah. is very, it's really inspiring, you know, and still it energizes us, you know? So it's like I think there's a lot of people that are scared of it because they think it's going to alienate people from your audience. And that's probably true too, as well, but it's worth it, you know, because you gain so much from it and you're doing something with your life that is so much bigger than who you are. And it also teaches you a lot. I mean, I'm holding a mirror to myself. I mean, I'm part of the journey of growth. Like I'm always learning. Like I'm always tripping up too. You know, I'm always having conversations with really important like mentors and especially like people of color that are doing so much great work. And I'll leave the conversation and be like, oh my God, I said the stupidest things. I have to like learn, you know, I'll say things that are, I don't know, just like very white, like privileged things that I won't think about until later. I'll be like, oh, that's like, I should have checked myself about that or something. You know what I mean? So I'm still learning.
I totally know what you mean. I mean, in this forum, what we're doing right now has become increasingly terrifying for me because, you know, words matter, but things are changing and evolving at a rate that, you know, none of us can really get a grasp on. And if you think you have a grasp on it, you're probably even further behind than you should be. But I think if you dare to have the conversation and you're coming from a place of love and you're coming from a place of questioning and like even you saying this and being humble as you are, having been exposed to all the different communities and experiences that you have is the loving thing to do. I mean, just asking.
Yeah.
I want to touch on something that I've heard you say in a couple different interviews in the process of making If It All Goes South. You refer to your own misogyny that you were trying to deal with and confront, having grown up in the South. And I'm sure there's a myriad number of things that also contribute to this misogyny you're talking about. But hearing you say that, as enlightened as you are, like just shows your willingness to explore. And like, what do you perceive that misogyny to be? Like, what is it?
It's a little bit layered in with internalized homophobia, you know, because I think sexism and misogyny are oftentimes immersed in like they're married in some way. Mm-hmm. So I think what it is like when I'm looking at myself, my own gender, or I'm feeling myself, I'm trying to always struggle against like, am I uncomfortable with the female part of me because I have a societal sort of misogyny inside that just, as you age as a woman, it's harder and harder, and you're taking in all that kind of negative stuff, but also you're throwing it at yourself because you see all these men around you aging so gracefully in some way, and in the music business especially. And so I'm like, what part of this is my own misogyny about just women, you know, because I've grown up thinking men are cooler and, you know, being more attracted to the male protagonist and listening to all male musicians. And then I think, like, when I look at our audience and you have that drive to say, like, hey, I wish we had, you know, more diversity in our audience, you know, do you mean not just race, but you're also talking about, you have a lot of women in your audience, and for some reason you feel not as validated because of that. And so everyone's trying to get more young people, more straight guys, more, you know, it's like we're always fighting for all these other things. And I'm always just questioning that, you know, like, why is that touch on that part of my ego, you know? And I think it's just some really just like I have an underlying level of racism from growing up. We all probably do in the United States, you know? And it's like, I have this base level of misogyny too, I'm sure, you know? And so I have to try to separate that from, like, my own just reality of being kind of a masculine female and my own sort of gender dysphoria growing up, and figure out, like, you know, and I don't overthink it, because if you dwell on yourself for that long, you're just like self-involved. But I know that I can see the misogyny come out, you know, and I fight, like, just, I remember Kathleen Hanna used to say, like, you know, when you're interviewed and they're asking you, like, what your favorite records are, you're apt to, like, throw out all these male bands, right? Because it's what you know and what you're conditioned to know and what's archived, right? In the classics, right? Mm. Especially in my age group, you know, like in the 50s, growing up, I'm 58. So, like, a lot of, like, the Rolling Stone type stuff, it was very male oriented. So the things I go to are male, right? But if you make a list of the records that you really love and you try to keep that, like, remember that, you'll throw out women too in the conversation. Because you do have these records that you love by women, but they don't come to your mind first because we're conditioned in this certain way. And Kathleen Hanna said she used to carry a list around for interviews because she said she would get sort of befuddled and not know what to say and would just be like, Fugazi, you know, or whatever, you know, like, and who's great, but, like, also, like, so is Chrissy Hynde, you know, it's like, so is Patti Smith, like, say, you know, or Fanny, you know, one of the first female rock bands, like, remember those things. And she was like, and Dara Williams used to talk about this too, because we haven't archived women enough, you know, and we're starting to more, but we haven't enough, you know, so women bass players, women guitar players, drummers, you know, all these things, right? Women DJs, like, whatever. Like, so that's one thing that I think we can do as artists and as journalists and anybody putting the word out there, is to try to remember to archive, you know, and remind people of the really great women out there.
Absolutely.
That helps with misogyny.
There's also just that, like, you're on the spot, need to answer who your influences are, and you want to be, you know, validated and show that you're here to play. And you're like, Bob Dylan, and the Beatles, the Stones, like, I'm cool. I know good American music, but they should be rolling off of our tongue more easily. Like Joni Mitchell, I mean, she's the queen. We all love her, but, like, still the level of reverence that she should be getting should be right there with Bob Dylan.
And oh, yeah.
It's just,
oh, my
the
God.
Readiness
of
just those qualifiers of music that stood the test of time at the top of the list. You're still needing to kind of take off these certain names just to kind of be considered.
Yeah. Yeah.
In examining this misogyny that you talk about, that you're kind of directing toward yourself, doesn't that make you more empathic toward the person with opposing views, because you realize, like, it's a little bit of programming that they're a victim of?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, definitely. I mean, it should give me empathy. I mean, I think there's times with...
It's hard.
I have like younger male friends sometimes that are still stuck in Bob Dylan land, you know, and I love Bob Dylan, but, like, he's not the end all and be all, you know?
Yeah, respect to Bob Dylan, but yeah, it's not a prerequisite.
I definitely take them to task sometimes, and then I look at myself and I think, oh my God, I'm just like just as guilty, you know, so it should give me empathy. I try to conjure that up, but sometimes I just get, you know, waylaid well, by like the white male tendency to still be bowing to the same heroes. And I love the men in my life that are like, when you ask them who they love, it's like, you know, Ricky Lee Jones, you know, it's like, yeah, great. Like you could, like some people are just scared to say it. I mean, honestly, I used to meet all these guys when we were coming up that would be like, I'm a closet Indigo Girl fan. And I'm like, why are you in the closet? Like, what's yeah. up? And he'd be come like, you know, he's like, well, my wife really loves you guys, but I really love y'all too. And, you know, sometimes I just feel like it's all women at the shows. And I'm just like, oh my God, we are just, it's like, we are so far from where we need to be, you know?
Absolutely.
We've made progress, you know, because there's a new generation of men that are amazing, you know, and have like, and a lot of women that are, I think, just more able to be freely claim feminism in a way that there was a gap of time when people were really afraid to. Mm-hmm. I mean, even someone like, I remember Chrissy Hynde telling me like, I don't really call myself a feminist. And I was like, why? Like, but you know, she had her reasons and they're good reasons, you know, and because you're just hit over the head all the time if you do. But it's also like sad. Like, can't we call ourselves that? You know, isn't it okay?
Yes.
But I guess, you know, for some people it wasn't. But now there's a, you know, like a lot of people coming up, I think that younger people that I know that are in their 20s and they're radical. It's awesome. You know, I wish they would vote, but that's a whole other thing, you know.
But I mean, you have so many women involved on this record and you've helped so many phenomenal female artists kind of rise up to be able to have a career in music. I mean, you featured Brandi Carlile on this record, Alison Russell, Natalie Hemby, who I love. I'm With Her is playing all over this. Of course, there are members of your own band that are female. And Alison Brown, who started Compass Records. Like, what a badass.
Yeah, what a badass. Yeah. Although having said that, you know, my touring band is all guys, which everybody always, my friends are always like, yeah, that's pretty weird, Amy. That you have I'm like, why? It's like, these are the people I play with. Like, it's not, you know, they're all good people. I'm not going to like do something just for the sake of it. My idea is that you want everybody to have the same opportunity. So I'm like all about women musicians all the time. And it just happened this way. And it's like, you know, it's just funny to me because I'm like, okay, guys, we have to have, one thing when I went to make this record is I called Sound Emporium in Nashville and I was like, I want a female assistant engineer because it's all guys and we have to have more women in this project. And we got one. And, you know, and one of the guys in my band was like, not in my band, but one of my producers was like a friend. He was like, why do you have to have that? And I'm like, oh my God, come on. You know, it's like, why do I have to explain this to you? You're like my best friend. Like,
well, also, it shouldn't be to the detriment of your music. It shouldn't be a shtick either. Right. I mean, like, we don't want to ghettoize each other by saying, oh, by default, you're going to be a part of this because you're a woman. That hopefully we get to a point where this isn't something that people are scrutinizing at all. And it's just something you're able to do.
Yeah. And there are enough great women musicians that would never be the case. I mean, Alison Brown, you know, she's like a prime example. I mean, and Sarah Jarosz.
Yeah.
It's insane how good people
Sarah
are.
Sarah Watkins. Damn.
Sarah Watkins, I mean, I know.
And I don't know Effie O'Donovan. Is that how you say her name?
It's Aoife O'Donovan.
Aoife.
So she's a young, youngish singer-songwriter who's just kind of in this community of people that are a lot of bluegrassers too. She is an amazing songwriter and singer. And I discovered her by listening to I'm With Her because it's like the power trio of Sarah Watkins and Aoife and Sarah Jarosz. And then I really got into her music too. So it's, yeah, she's younger, up and comer. And it's just, her command is pretty incredible. Like when you see her, it's just, her voice, her pitch, her melodies, her guitar playing. It's all just kind of in this state of fragileness that's just beautiful, you know?
See, yet another musician that you're exposing me and many others to, and what a gift. It's what you do. We help.
I'm a fan. I'm a fan of music. So, you know, I spend a lot of time listening.
Sadness is defeat. That aching in your heart surely bears repeating, but it takes all day to gather up the strength to sing this song. I get lost.
I get lost.
Sad and lonely.
Sad and lonely.
So I count the stars above me. And I sing, when I should be sleeping. 'Cause as when the world hears my weeping.
I also have to say, in defense of, not that you need it, of having an all-male touring band, it's an incontrovertible fact that it's harder, that climate is harder for women to do for a long period of time, being out on the road, because the traditional duties of the family are still falling to women. I mean, we can't pretend that's not the case. So anyone who wants to be critical of the fact that it's easier for you to accumulate an all-male band who's willing to go hit the road with you, hit the road with anyone in a van, in a touring bus, whatever, be away from their families, that's how it is. And if anyone wants to help change that, then great. But that's not something that you alone are going to be able to change. That reality is probably here to stay for a long time, unless the culture changes out on the road and just in the industry in general.
Yeah, it's a great observation. Really great. True and true.
I mean, I have one female player in my band. She's a keyboard player. She's been with me for almost 6 years now, but you know, she's a rarity, and like having that camaraderie on the road is so important to me. But it's hard to source musicians who are going to be able to have the luxury to be out on the road and have also the things that they want out of their experience in womanhood, being a mother. Like, it's hard for me to figure that shit out. I don't know when I'm going to be able to do it.
That's a really great observation, you know, and I should reflect on that, because you're right. I mean, and when I think about the guys in my band, one just had a baby. He's like one of my best friends, and he's staying home. We're not going to go out until February, but like, he can still go out. Do you know what I mean? Like, when I said, hey, we can just not tour for a long time and just wait till you've had your time. He's like, no, I told Tekla, you know, his wife, who's also a musician, that I would need to, you know, go out and work. And she's so supportive. And it is still, I mean, there's no fault in that arrangement, but it still is, you're right. We kind of tend to this, well, it's because the moms are nursing and, you know, or if they're not doing that, they're the main caregiver often, you know?
Right.
And so it's very complicated.
Yeah.
Because my partner is also allowing me to be able to go do that, you know?
Right.
And it's like, it just, you fall into these roles. And then as a woman, you are really struggling with how to have career and mother. And then when your parents are getting older too, helping take care of them. Because there is this, it's in society still. Yeah. And I don't know how to bust it all up, but we have to.
Yeah. Like, if these are the best musicians that you should be playing with, you should be honoring your music and the ones that are available to play with you. Hopefully things will become easier to where we can really, quote unquote, have it all. But there's guilt in that too. So anyway, I digress. Hey guys, it's Maggie. I hope you had a wonderful 4th of July holiday, and I'm so glad that we're back with new episodes of Salute the Songbird, and especially with this conversation with Amy Ray, which I found to be so enlightening and inspiring. It definitely sent me on a bit of a self-exploration as well, because she's someone who's so thoughtful and self-aware, yet she concedes to having these feelings of internalized homophobia, misogyny. She's wondering why she has a desire to, you know, have more men in her audience and younger people when she has such a loyal fan base that
is comprised mostly of women, that's a great thing. Why wouldn't it seem like a great thing? But she's being honest with herself, and she's addressing that these feelings are there and attributing these feelings to her ego. But the irony of that to me is anyone who's willing to do this and explore how they can overcome or identify why those feelings are there is experiencing a bit of ego death, which I think is a wonderful thing to be able to attempt. So I love her acceptance of herself, and it also gives her a path to overcome and grow and just continue becoming a better version of herself, which Amy Ray has done throughout her career. She just keeps evolving and keeps becoming more and more enlightened, and it's so inspiring to see. And also, I love how this practice is her not letting herself off the hook for any of these feelings, but understanding that these are circumstances that she could not avoid. This is programming, and we all have a little bit of that. It doesn't make us bad people. It's just how we deal with that programming. She talks about how growing up in the South also affected her. And there's all these things that are out of our control. But if we want to overcome and do good, she's an example that we can. She's amazing. Let's get back to our conversation. I wanted to touch on someone whom you mentioned, who I was not familiar with before, a Native American activist, among other things, named Winona LaDuke, who helped you in your examination of gender dysphoria and even the process of getting older. Can you speak to that?
Well, it's Winona, and it's her sisters. The Indigenous Women's Network was this group, and they still exist, but a few of the founding mothers passed away, and they were my elders. And Winona's the sort of the person I spend the most time with, probably, and Cynthia Perez, another leader from that community. And I don't know, it's the way it's in Native communities, there's an intergenerational quality to things that is just so different from in white communities. And they, and activism is intergenerational too. So we are on a tour bus, and Winona's on, and then her kids, and then maybe there's somebody else that has to ride with us for one of the drives who's like an elder who's in, you know, her 80s or whatever. And there's this beauty that's happening where everyone's humanity is honored equally, right? So there's not this feeling of like, especially older women, there's not this feeling of like, they don't have the same humanity anymore. They don't have, you know, passion and sensuality and like, and knowledge and, you know, anything. And they're not as relevant, you know, in the Native communities that I've been in, there is just a difference with how you look at older folks, men and women, but women especially. And there's a beauty in aging that honors you as you age. And, you know, having Winona in my life has really helped me understand how to just be okay with it, you know, and honor it. And also a lot of the women in that Indigenous Women's Network were there. A lot of them are just, they're very different from each other. You know, there's some that are, you know, two-spirited. There's some that are more masculine. There's some that are super femme. It's like all walks of life kind of in this one group that's doing all this great work together. And they're constantly honoring each other. I don't know. It's just freeing for me, you know, because I'm seeing it in the Native community. You know, and I can see it in my own community in certain pockets, you know, but like the Michigan Women's Fest was really great about that because there were so many elders there. And so you would really understand the importance of looking at aging as this thing of beauty, right? And I struggle with that because just, I mean, mainly because I just don't want to die, you know, I just, because I love life, you know, I mean, you know, so that's
a struggle. I don't want you to either.
No, I mean, I don't know anybody that want, you know, it's like mortality is just a hard thing for us, right?
Yeah.
For humans. So I think it's all wrapped up in that. But anyway, yeah, Winona has been a true friend and mentor and just does her stuff. Nothing stops her. Like she's out riding horses on the pipeline to protest it. She's getting arrested. She's on the front lines. There's like, you know, a whole bunch of like Native women that are all in their 70s and 80s sitting in little lawn chairs across a highway to block a, you know, an oil tanker thing. It's just, I don't know. Seeing that is like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, what am I complaining about? Like, just do it, right? Just do it. Just do the things you want to do. Don't think about your age, right? So it's a breath of fresh air to be around that, honestly.
Well, yet another figure that you've introduced me to. I can't wait to study her up and learn more about her. I want to talk about this incredible album, If It All Goes South. First of all, great title. The double entendre is fantastic. Why did you want to do it to tape?
I've always done as much to tape with the solo stuff as I can. And the country stuff, the first record I did was in 2014 or 2012. I can't remember. Anyway, it was the first country record was called Goodnight Tender. And I just had this thing where I was like, if it's country, I want to record to tape. I want to try to do as much of it live as possible. But for that one and the next one, Holler, we recorded to tape, but we transferred it to Pro Tools at a super high resolution to try to capture everything. And it was just a function of like what we had the money to do as far as mixing, you know, because mixing from Pro Tools is a lot easier, to be honest.
You didn't want to get the razor blades out. And
yeah, exactly. But this time, the engineer, Bobby Tees, who also does all Tedeschi Trucks stuff, he worked on the last record, but he was like, I want to mix this and we can mix, you know, to tape, from tape to tape. And I was like, okay, let's try it, you know? And he's like, but it means like no tuning vocals. These are all your limits. And I was like, I love those. Perfect.
You sound like a human. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds great. Of course, when you're in there listening to an out of tune note, you're like, oh, I wish I could pitch that, you know, but you have to punch it in. I mean, I punched in things, but so it was just because we wanted to do the whole thing like tape, like, you know, just like master it from the half inch and, you know, cut the lacquer from that and all that stuff. So we did all that, so the records won't come out till the winter. Cause as you know, there's not enough record pressing places.
Oh my God.
That's an industry to get involved in.
Yeah. Anyone listening who wants to help musicians get their vinyl on time. I ordered my replacement like 7 months ago. I'm still waiting.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Woman only record pressing plant.
Let's go.
Good. Like, yeah. Yeah, no. So that's it. Just love the process, the warmth of it. I like the visceral quality of the tape and how you can really see where everything it's, you know, you can see it. It's 2-inch, 24 tracks, and they're all on the tape. You can watch them go by, you know. I love that. It's cool. And also I like the limitation of it too, you know, because it's exciting, you know, like we would have like a song where we would do everything live and the string section would be playing and Gabe Dixon would be out there conducting and playing keys and then someone else playing piano too and everything going at once, right? And it's just like everybody's excited. So the song,
that's cool,
you know, so it turns out better because you're all excited about it.
And you had Gabe Dixon on it, who's part of Tedeschi Trucks band, and what an incredible player. And the urgency that you create by having a live tracking session going down on tape, it really is like the most alive you can feel in that moment. You're not thinking about the future or the past. And that's one of those rare moments of creating something that really puts you in that moment. Like, this is your chance. And just like the camaraderie between everyone in the room and the fact that you all need to be, you know, living and dying by each other's playing is exciting. If you pull it off, which you did.
You got to be supportive of each other. Because if you start being mean or calling somebody out for making mistakes and ruining the take.
That dark cloud rolls in fast. Yeah.
And the next take, you're screwing up.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and that dark cloud does roll in fast. I've had it. Right. I've made it. I've made
There's
the
a lesson
cloud.
In humility. Yeah. Right there. Jackson, Jackson, all the way to that Mississippi town. When Medgar Evers haunts me, I swear he follows me around. I saw him riding with Christ Calvary and the horses and the hounds.
mean, I was jovial because I was saying to myself, you know, look at these great, like, civil rights leaders that sort of haunt you. You think about them all the time. Because I do think about the history of the South constantly. Because I don't know, I'm from a lot of generations in the South, and it's, there's a lot, you know what I mean? And there's a lot of, like, things in our past, so, that I know about. So I just think about it a lot. So yeah, but I was like, one, I guess it was at a gig, and I was like, God, you know, why am I so, like, down and sad and cynical and negative, you know, when I have such a great life? And I was just thinking about the people that I really respect that can be so positive in the face of, like, struggle and stuff.
Right.
So I was like, get on the joy train, you know, basically to myself. And, you know, then I just, there was a lot of different songs in there, and I just pieced them all together, which happens
sometimes. I loved it. I mean, it was a great history lesson as well, but you're right. I mean, these people made the choice, and they really had no reason to make a choice to see the bright side of things and hope for change.
Yeah. And then Alice, and then you got Alison Brown. She brings joy. That banjo playing that she does is, like, something that you kind of can't help but, like, smile about, because it's so, like, whoa, how did she do that? You know, it just makes you on your toes, you know, when you're listening.
Absolutely. And she, I think, is someone who sees how broken this industry is, and yet she's going to try and help other artists get heard. And bluegrass is the genre she rallies around. But there's, so, I mean, Sarah Watkins, all the people that she's helped out.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's someone who kind of, who chooses to see that silver lining too.
Yeah. Yeah. She's awesome.
You talk about just all the relics of the South and how you have been thinking about them. And the South really can be a personification for so many people who are trying to rid themselves of the vestiges of racism and all the problems we have. That song that you invited Alison Russell to sing with you, Tear It Down, talks about all these Southern monuments that we see just kind of in our daily lives and just how harmful they are. Why did you want to reach out to Alison in particular for this collaboration?
Well, it's interesting because I had recorded that song and put it out during the pandemic with just me, for a group called Project South out of Florence, Alabama, that was doing a really cool kind of dismantling racism sort of program. And part of it was trying to get this monument relocated in downtown Florence. And
I know the one.
There you go. Okay, because you've recorded in that area. So yeah. Mm-hmm. So I did that and I put it out. But then I was in Mexico when we were having that Brandy's Festival or whatever, and Alison was playing, and I was watching her, and I was like, oh man, I gotta, like, redo that song and have Alison, because it needs to have that, her voice. I just, you know, that's just what I felt. So I did. And I asked her.
She's pretty undeniable.
Yeah. 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 She's just, she's awesome. She's awesome.
Tell me if I'm wrong. You redid two songs, They Won't Have Me, which was originally from Despite Our Differences in 2006.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then you also redid Chuck Will's Widow from your last album, Holler.
Chuck Will's Widow was another single I put out in the pandemic. So it wasn't Holler. It was just a song that my band and I were just, like, trying to do something together through email. So, and those songs are started out digital, and we transferred them to tape, but Chuck Will's Tear It Down. Oh, and another song, Muscadine, I did during the pandemic, but They Won't Have Me. It's all kind of, yeah, it was an Indigo Girls song, and I just covered it. We covered it. And then, and Chuck Will's Widow, we did it just for fun during the pandemic, but I didn't totally love how we played it. So I was thinking about what needed to change, and I guess I had been listening to him with her or something. And I was like, oh God, that's the band that can make it happen. So I just asked them to, you know.
Yeah, they were cooking on it.
Yeah.
It was awesome. They Won't Have Me, for obvious reasons, really felt like a great song to revisit during this time of social justice awareness. And, like, what were any sonic elements that you wanted to apply to the reimagining of it?
You know, as a band, we were just thinking about, like, I wanted to pull out a little bit more of the strident kind of apocalyptic feel for me, of, like, sort of the, I think we start out, you know, sort of pastoral, obviously, with, like, this kind of almost Ren Faire sort of vibe, like Led Zeppelin in the 70s or something. Yeah. And then I just wanted it to explode, because that's how I feel, you know, mm-hmm. and I feel this sense of desperation about it, honestly, and sort of panic in a way.
Yeah.
Because I live in the country. I've lived in the woods for 30 years now, and I am a country person. I like the woods. And I just always come back to this idea that no one can own a place to live. Like, you can't just be driven out of somewhere because you don't agree with each other mm-hmm. on either side. I wouldn't want, you know, a Republican friend feeling like they can't live in a neighborhood because there's a bunch of Stacey Abrams signs everywhere.
Right.
I want everyone to feel like they can live where they want to live. And I really have a desperation about that sometimes, because I'm just like, why does it have to be like this? Like, I'll be the first one to give back to this community, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I will. I'll always do that. And I'll always honor everybody else's contributions and who they are and in this community and kind of how hard they work and stuff like that. I'm never, you know, it just feels like why would it come down to this? And I think it's because we've just been divided by just, you know, the power brokers, you know,
yeah,
who want money and who want power, and they divide everybody else to get it.
That might be why you have a tendency to work like with your activism more on a community based level, because then you can get your fissures into like what's really going on instead of trying to do some huge global effort, even though yeah. those are worthy. It's just, you know, this is a community you live in, and
yeah,
you can reach out to people right there.
It takes both. I mean, and even people that do global work, they're doing it through local, if they're effective.
Right.
They're doing it through a local dialogue.
Holding hands with girls down the streets and avenues. Make it count in the music bit. And that's what you did. But me, I am still wondering. Cause I crave to try. Can't shake it from my mind. You saw me every time. You saw me every time.
Of course, you're honoring Rita Houston, whom I never had the privilege of meeting, but I can't even number the amount of people and friends of mine who have been touched by this person, Rita Houston.
And that's cool.
I know that she had played a big role in your career and a big role in Brandy's. Just anything that you would like to say about that collaboration and honoring her?
Rita was like one of the most important people in the music community that I knew, you know, and for her honesty and professionalism and support of queer artists in the way of like just looking at them as artists, you know, and not.
Yeah.
And just seeing the full humanity of everybody that she worked with, no matter who they were. And so I think that's hard to do in radio, because you always have this sense that everybody wants something from you. They want their song played, you know, and you're just like this person that either can or can't, right?
Right.
And she didn't operate that way. You know, she wasn't scared to say it's not fitting in right now or it's great, either one. That didn't affect her relationship with you. As an artist, it was like you still felt good about what you do, you know? And I think that's a beautiful thing, you know? So, and she just got everybody excited about new music all the time and could just, you know, inspire people, right? And then she was just so active and always going to hear things and always like trying to get the station to evolve in certain ways. And I don't know, just that was a joyful person.
Yeah.
Like so full of life that... It was inspiring to me. So, and she helped Brandy a lot, and Brandy was one of her favorite musicians. So, yeah, so I asked Brandy to sing on the song because I just was like, this is for Rita, you know, and of course Brandy loved Rita, so she did it. That one was digital, and we transferred it into the tape session, which is a bear to do, but worth it, because I sent it to her and she did like 10 million vocals. It was like a Brandy chorus, you know?
I'd love to just hear those. Files.
No, I'm going to definitely make like a,
yeah.
I have a stem of it. I have to get her permission because I was going to release it like on, you know, SoundCloud or something, you know, because it's really cool and beautiful.
Yeah.
and kind of crazy.
Well, I would love to hear what you do with that. And what a great tribute to someone who's really helped cultivate seemingly so many musicians and had a strong sense of self, even, you know, in all the gray areas that, you know, we can categorize ourselves in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That's Rita.
She seemed pretty badass. I wish I had met her. But you are badass, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. I hope we get to meet each other soon and work together soon.
I want to see you play. I sing and play. I love the kind of music that you're into right now, because that country soul thing, it's like that Dusty Springfield. I mean, I'm not just like saying this, like the production too is like, whoa, it's just the whole thing is just great to listen to.
Thank you.
Well, that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with the incredible Amy Ray. I certainly did. Make sure to keep up with her on her socials at Amy Ray Music. Go check out her incredible album, If It All Goes South, and go out and see the Indigo Girls on the road. Salute the Songbird is hosted by Maggie Rose. That's me. Produced by Austin Marshall, Maggie Rose, and Kirsten Cluthi, with production assistance from Kip Baggett. Distributed in partnership with Osiris Media. Edited by Tom Maxwell. Music by Maggie Rose. Graphics by Mark Dowd. You can listen to past episodes on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd love to know what you think. Please rate and review us wherever you listen to the show. Follow us on our socials at I Am Maggie Rose. Get updates and tour news at MaggieRoseMusic.com. To close out this episode, I'm going to leave you from If It All Goes South with Tear It Down by Amy Ray featuring Allison Russell. Take care. Thanks for listening.
And fool of a king. Don't you know that old Dixieland is more than dirt roads and simple ways? Tear it down, tear it down, that ragged cross. Live and breathe in me, and it wants to live again. again. We must fight with all our might to kill that racist in. Tear it down, oh, tear it down.
Osiris.